everyone, and welcome back to the New Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. This time around, we're going to explore the psychological nature and revolutionary narrative structure behind the 1971 neo-noir classic, Clue, starring Hollywood legends Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. So be sure to tune in and enjoy this wonderful talkback episode along with our special audience Q&A.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Laurie had mentioned a film called FTA, which also features Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. It was made right after they made Clute, and it's a documentary of their anti-war concerts that were performed at that time. Clute came out, as Laurie indicated, during this very intense year, 1971. It was one of a series of very memorable and provocative films that Warner Brothers produced and released that year. Probably one of the most provocative and controversial lineups of director-driven films that any studio has offered in one single year, I think, in Hollywood's history. You had Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Ken Russell's X-Rated The Devils. Clockwork Orange was also rated X originally. Luchino Visconti's masterpiece, Death in Venice, and even Don Siegel's Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood raised a lot of eyebrows and caused a lot of controversy. And we have the film that Dan Cale are going to be discussing today, Alan J. Pakula's Clute. There really wasn't a term neo-noir yet in 1971, but that's what Clute is, a film that Pakula clearly wanted to evoke the memories of the classic film noir, but obviously with a more modern twist. And Dan Cale and I are going to be talking about the artists behind the films, the theme of the film, and Dan is going to talk actually about the visual look of the film as well. But to get us in the spirit of things, here is the original Clute trailer from 1971.
Ree Daniels.
One man is missing. Two girls lie dead, and somebody is on the other end of the phone. Don't be afraid.
The narrator keeps saying, don't be afraid, but it's hard not to be afraid when you're watching Clute, especially the way it has been directed and photographed, which we're going to talk about. Gary Palmucci, our film programmer, is traveling today, so my partner in crime is going to be Dan Cahill. He's an award-winning filmmaker with a master's degree in film and TV production from New York University. He has decades of experience in screenwriting, directing, editing, and cinematography. He's a member of the Writers Guild of America. He's taught directing at the New York Film Academy and also has conducted a filmmaking workshop in Morocco. And of course, Dan loves New Plaza Cinema. And Dan, we're so happy to have you with us today to talk about Clute.
Thank you very much, Max. I appreciate the intro. It's great to be here with an extended commentary for once.
Well, it's great to have you. Dan, this film was a success when it was released in 1971. It seems to stand out among thrillers that were made at that time. Now, I know we're talking about a transitional time in Hollywood. It's the so-called New Hollywood, post-Easy Rider, pre-Godfather. Directors are being given a lot more control by the studios. There's this short, small window of artistic opportunity that directors are using to their advantage. And I know we'll talk more about that. What do you think about it, how it stands out for its time and our continued fascination with the film 50 years later?
Well, one thing I will comment on, which is doesn't really answer your question, but it is unique about the film. It's 50 years old. And not only are the two lead actors still alive, but they're still very active in their careers, which you don't see very often. One thing that I think sets it apart from most thrillers, at least, is that it's also a very deep character study. And we learn a lot about Bree Daniels, much less about the title character, John Clute. But Bree, through these marvelous therapy sessions, reveals so much of why she's doing what she's doing and how she feels about it. And I will just say, as someone who has both written screenplays and taught the writing of screenplays, one of the paramount rules is don't tell it, show it. Play it out dramatically. But these therapy sessions break that rule. She is just talking about what is important to her, and yet it works. I think part of that is due to the fact that they were largely improvised, at least the takes that they used in the final version. They just kind of turned her loose, and it worked very well.
I was wondering about that. It would be, as you know, Daniel, I'm sure it's easier to get your hands on military secrets than it is on screenplays from the studios. And I would love to see some of the early drafts of the Klute script to see what changes were made, including these improvisations during production.
Well, I will make my case by simply saying, imagine Klute without the therapy sessions. It would be shallow, superficial, routine, cliched. Those scenes bring it to life.
They do bring it to life. And I know that particularly at one point when I was rewatching it recently, at some point when Klute is keeping an eye on her overnight and she's asleep and he walks over to her where she's sleeping and you hear her voiceover where she's having a therapy session. That clearly is something that would have had to come out, I would imagine, during the editing phase of the film. I just got that sense that that was an editing decision, but it works very effectively.
Oh yeah, it's beautiful counterpoint to what we're watching on the screen. We're hearing her private thoughts that may conflict with what we're looking at. It's brilliantly done.
It is. And is it me, or does the film lose interest in the disappearing man, Tom? It's kind of, and I know obviously everyone who's here today has seen Klute, so there aren't too many spoilers here, but his disappearance, of course, is what motivates the Klute character to go to New York. And there's some discussion about him, but I'm not saying it's a bad choice. I'm just finding it's an unusual choice that they didn't make a big deal about what happened to him. At that point, even we don't care that much because we're more concerned about Bree.
We are, but also the film reveals who the killer is about 40 minutes into the film. So we know it's Peter Cable, whom we've seen before, who is supposedly an ally of the family and trying to help find Tom. And that takes it out of the whodunit category and into the whydunit category. We don't know why Tom was killed, if he was killed. And eventually that's the mystery that we learn later on, that he knew too much about Peter. But this film breaks a lot of rules and does it very successfully.
And I like the fact that we knew Cable was the sinister figure early on, because it's what makes returning to the film very fresh. Because in a whodunit situation, when you know the ending, it's a little disappointing to see it again. But that does create this constant element of tension that runs through the film. So let's go back a little bit and talk about the people behind the scenes. And I thought an appropriate way to start would be director Alan Pakula. Dan, I can't remember how you worded it the other day. It was so funny. You talked about this generation of directors who were given a chance after Easy Rider. Was it the long-haired stoners? Is that how you were describing the directors given their breaks?
If you wanted to recreate the formula of Easy Rider, that's what you would go for. But Alan Pakula did not fit that description.
He definitely did not. This was only his second feature, but he was already an industry veteran by that time. He had produced Fear Strikes Out with his directing partner, Robert Mulligan. The two of them collaborated on To Kill a Mockingbird. And it was not until about over a decade later that he switched to directing with a film called The Sterile Cuckoo with Liza Minnelli. He came from the Bronx, and he graduated from Yale Drama School. In all my studies, I have never heard of a film director ever who said he wanted to be a director because he loved actors. Any theories on that?
No, except, you know, I can highlight the exact opposite being Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, it's the familiar quote about actors and cattle, and we don't have to repeat it because it doesn't apply here. But Pakula was one of a kind. I think they broke the mold after him.
They did, and I know you're going to talk more about the look of the film, but this was the first of what were, it wasn't officially supposed to be a trilogy, but there were two other films that make out part of this point in Pakula's career.
Yes, specifically The Parallax View and All the President's Men, and they were once again collaborations with the cinematographer Gordon Willis, And I'll say more about their relationship in a little while, but these films were referred to as the Paranoia Trilogy. And I can get a little clinical and say that, well, paranoia involved imaginary fears on the part of the person, the paranoid. But in these three films, the fears were very, very real. And maybe that helped induce some paranoia in the audience. I don't know.
No, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, Dan, I'm just remembering an interview that Pakula had with American Film Magazine. And I think it was after the Parallax View. He said one of his objectives was to make audiences in the theater feel very nervous about the person sitting next to them. Yes. So I think he achieved that very, very effectively. Yes. Before we get to Gordon Willis and The Look of Clute, let's talk a little bit about the two principals. We have Jane Fonda, who I consider to be in phase three of her film career at this point. She's in her early 30s. She's after some actor's studio work under Lee Strasberg. She's going to get the movie bug, start making films. In the early 60s, there's a balance of drama and even some romantic comedies. Phase two, she marries the director Roger Vadim, who's trying to shape her into another Bardot and puts her in Barbarella. And then she extricates herself from that situation. And we're in phase three now. She's just made Sidney Pollack's very serious They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And then she makes this film, Clute, which she will win an Academy Award for, during a very difficult time, challenging time in her life, because she's involved with anti-war activism. She's gone to North Vietnam to show solidarity with the North Vietnamese, and that's going to have all kinds of a political fallout here. Normally that might impact her winning the Oscar, but she still is given the Oscar in a very tense atmosphere the following year. Any other thoughts to share about Jane Fonda?
I will say that I look back at her filmography and rediscovered a title that I had seen decades and decades ago called Joy House, which yes. was filmed in France.
Yeah.
He co-stars with Alain Delon, and it's a pretty good film.
Rene Clément directed that.
Yes. It's hard to find. I'm not sure there is an American DVD release, but if you can catch it anywhere, check it out. She is very effective.
Yes, I believe that's a Warner Archive MGM title, but that was a period of time where she appeared for Rene Clément. She was directed by George Roy Hill in a period of adjustment. Cukor directed her in The Chapman Report and things like that.
And Barefoot in the Park.
And Barefoot in the Park, which was very, very successful.
That was a big hit for both her and Redford, and that helped make them stars as much as anything.
Absolutely, and it shows the range of her work, although she does have elements of humor or irony in her portrayal of Brie. It's a pretty dramatic part for her. And whereas for Donald Sutherland, this is a very, almost a straight role compared to some of the lunacy he had exhibited on screen the previous year for Robert Altman in MASH and Alan Arkin's very dark comedy, Little Murders, which was also photographed by Gordon Willis. And Sutherland played a hippie minister in that picture. So there's tremendous range in his work as well. He is going to, in future years, offset some commercial work like, you know, Animal House, Hunger Games, but with some much riskier pictures like The Day of the Locust, Fellini's Casanova, Robert Redford's Ordinary People, A Dry White Season, and so on. Of course, he and Jane Fonda, they're also in Juilliard Blues.
Yes. And I just have to cite one of the creepiest films of all time, Don't Look Now, directed by Nicholas Roeg. If you know it, you'll never forget it. If you haven't seen it, it's worth a look. Very definitely.
It's absolutely.
Sutherland's best performances, I think.
Yeah, he's an amazing, amazing screen presence. And they both, you'd think they were complete opposites, he and Fonda, in terms of screen presence, but they work together for some reason. Daniel, let's talk now about The Look of Clute. And I guess this starts off with Gordon Willis. Who is this guy, Gordon Willis? He's coming out of an era where the guy behind the camera is becoming a superstar. This is the era of Laszlo Kovacs and Haskell Wexler and Nestor Almendros and Vilmos Zsigmond, where audiences are becoming almost as aware of who's photographing the film as who's being photographed. And how does that affect The Look of Clute? Because this is, by the way, the year before he's going to photograph The Godfather.
Oh, yes. It's almost like a dry run for him. Talking about the visual style of Clute inevitably requires discussing the cinematographer, the late Gordon Willis. I'd like to quote the opening paragraph in this 47-page tribute in American Cinematographer magazine. Quote, ASC legend Gordon Willis, who passed away on May 18th, 2014, at age 82, is widely considered to be one of the greatest cinematographers in film history. Canonized by his fellow society members, Willis broke the mold with his daring and sometimes unconventional approaches to composition and lighting. His artful eye for framing has always been admired, but his taste for moody chiaroscuro, which often flirted with the bottom edge of the exposure curve, initially set him at odds with Hollywood executives, who considered his images too dark. His peers affectionately dubbed him the Prince of Darkness, but Willis hated the nickname. "It's proper exposure," he often grumbled, unquote. Clute was his first of six collaborations with Alan Pakula, who described him as, quote, "a huge influence on my life artistically. He gave me the courage to believe in my eye," unquote. Their next two films, as we said, were The Parallax View and All the President's Men. Willis is probably best remembered for shooting The Godfather trilogy for Francis Coppola and eight films for Woody Allen, including Annie Hall, Manhattan, and Zelig. He never won a competitive Oscar, having been nominated twice for The Godfather Part III and Zelig. In 2010, he received an honorary Oscar. His snubbing by the Hollywood establishment is likely due to his disdain for that sector. He once said, "I don't think it suffers from an overabundance of good taste." For Clute, Pakula and Willis chose to film in the widest possible aspect ratio, 2.39 to 1. Not every filmmaker was fond of the look. Fritz Lang famously declared that it was useful only for filming snakes and funeral processions. Those who did admire it were appreciative of the extra space, allowing for a wider choice in composing images. The choice of this wide format allowed Pakula and Willis to contrast different settings as group and family oriented, as opposed to isolating and lonely. The story begins in small town Tuscarora, Pennsylvania. A very convivial family early dinner scene. It's shot in daylight with lovely lush greenery outside. It looks rural, it looks inviting. You think the food is really good. This is part of the establishing of a norm in America, not to be followed through with in Manhattan, where the filmmakers contrast the wide horizontal frame with abrupt vertical lines, which separate people from each other. Bree Daniels is clearly set apart from other people on the street. But I wanted to discuss one other thing. In an interview, Alan Pakula referred to the scene where Clute has entered Bree's apartment for the first time as his favorite shot in the film. He's questioning her. He's asking her all the questions he wanted to ask. And in the middle of the scene, he hears something and we see him look up. And she has just started trying to seduce him to get the tape recordings of these phone calls away from him. So what does he do? He takes her and takes her into the bedroom. We don't ever see either of their faces in this shot. We hear him say, "There's someone on the roof." The reaction that she gives is through her hands in the mirror. They stop massaging him and they freeze, utterly fearful. The cliched thing to do would be to cut to a shot of her face, gasping and cringing. But here we see something much more subtle and downright clever. No wonder Pakula was proud of that shot.
I was wondering when I was watching it recently, I said, it's interesting we're not seeing their faces at that very pivotal scene. That's a brilliant observation. Daniel, that was just great. That really gives us a sense of the visual look of Clute. Could you tell us, one of the effective elements of Clute is the music. And Dan, I know you know your film music very well. This is an era where it's post Max Steiner and pre John Williams, technically. Yes. And the music scores are scaled down a bit. I get a sense the composers are given a lot more freedom for a short time. This is not a bombastic score. It's a very subtle and yet very, very unnerving score. And Michael Small is going to collaborate with the Pakula quite a number of times. But can you tell us your thoughts on the score and what makes it work?
Well, I would say the main thing is unconventional instrumentation. It doesn't sound like it was conducted and performed by a studio orchestra. There is a piano, there is a bell, and there are chimes. And woven throughout is this discordant female voice, not quite singing anything recognizable. And I found a review of this particular soundtrack that said it was reminiscent of Rosemary's Baby. Rosemary's Baby came out a few years before Klute, so it could have been an inspiration. And another one cited was an Italian slasher film, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. Mm-hmm. And the soundtrack in that was composed by probably the best soundtrack composer of all time, the Italian Ennio Morricone. And we have to do a program all about his work at some point.
Believe me, I totally agree with you on that. And Christopher Cameda had done the score for Rosemary's Baby, which I believe was Mia Farrow singing in a very frail, creepy voice, a kind of a lullaby at the beginning. Yes, there's a connection to that.
And one more thing about Michael Small, his filmography is very productive, very prolific. He had a 30-year career, during which time he had 57 composing credits on features. And rather than name some of those titles, I will rattle off six or seven directors that he worked for, who pretty much are a who's who of the late 20th century. People like Sidney Lumet, Arthur Penn, Robert Wise, John Schlesinger, James Bridges, Bob Rafelson, and Michael Apted. And of course, Alan Pakula. So these people knew what they were getting when they got a Michael Small score, and clearly they kept coming back for more.
Absolutely. And there are a couple of other actors who deserve some mention here today. Of course, playing Bree's pimp is Roy Scheider, who is just on the brink of achieving stardom in 1971, a few months later, in The French Connection. He made his professional stage debut in the early 60s for the New York Shakespeare Festival production of Romeo and Juliet. It was Mercutio, I believe. And then he's doing television work throughout the 50s and throughout the 60s. His first major film is going to be Erwin Kirshner's Loving, which Gordon Willis photographed a year before Klute. And then Jerry Schatzberg directed him in Puzzle of a Downfall Child, and then came Klute. And of course, the rest is film history. Obviously, the 1970s are a major, major role for Scheider as he appears in Jaws, Marathon Man, all that jazz, and so forth. And very briefly, we see a fantastic actress who, obviously, when the film was in production, they didn't know how famous she was going to be. Jean Stapleton, who audiences already knew as Edith Bunker, because 3 months before Klute came out, All in the Family premiered on CBS. We see her briefly in the, I want to call it a sweatshop, but let's say the garment shop that Klute is going to visit. Also, I remember in that scene where Bree visits that older man who runs the garment shop, the Michael Small music changes. It's a very beautiful theme of almost like mandolin music at that point. That's very, very memorable. Could you talk a little bit about the elements that Jane Fonda brought to the part as an actress? For instance, you mentioned how the therapy scenes were very, very unusual, that those came out of improvisations. There's another scene that you normally wouldn't see in a thriller where she's back home early on from a busy day at work and she lights up a joint. Could you tell us how that came about?
Well, according to her story, she was sitting there relaxing while they lighted the scene. You know, you always need a stand-in, and I guess she was happy to be on the set right then. And she started spontaneously singing this hymn, "We Gather Together." Don't ask me for the rest of the lyrics, but she said it was a hymn that her family sang when she was a child. And it just came to her spontaneously. And part of being a good director is being alert to little moments that crop up, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes a little contrivedly, but it was Pakula who said, "Oh, that's lovely, let's keep that in there." And there it stayed when they shot the take. So the other thing that she did, which both Max and I missed the first time we rewatched the film, but it's in the scene where she and Klute are shopping at a fruit market on the street. And you have to watch very carefully because you're distracted away from what happens by the fact that Klute is actually buying fruit and exchanging money with the vendor. But what she does is she sort of turns her back a little bit and reaches behind herself and steals an apple and slides it into her shoulder bag. And she just did that on her own, thinking this is something Bree Daniels would do. It vaguely reminds me a little bit, pardon me for evoking my favorite film, but Fay Wray in King Kong steals an apple from a vendor early in the film, which is how she meets Robert Armstrong's character. I doubt that they were thinking that, but
probably not.
I have to just say it occurred to me.
So. No, that's terrific. Daniel, this has been so wonderful. And I know we have questions and thoughts that our viewers would like to share with us right now. Lori will assist me and assist us in calling on people to share their questions.
Marjorie, you're up first.
I just really have a few comments, and I agree with Dan wholeheartedly. When I first saw this movie, the crime, the murder, all of that was secondary to the therapy sessions. I think that was the core of this movie, which really stuck in my mind. And as a matter of fact, I was even disappointed in the trailer because it was just portrayed as a thriller. But the therapy sessions gave such insight to the film and where Jane Fonda was at. And speaking of the photography and the direction, that part where she visits the man in the sweatshop, I don't know who was responsible, but they do a far shot and they just show her walking back and forth with her clothes on. You can't understand what she's saying, and it's a far shot. And I think ordinarily that would have been a close-up, but that was such brilliantly done because really what she was saying wasn't important, but you can see that she's just walking back and forth, fully dressed, talking to this man, which was extremely important that she just wasn't a call girl for sex. So I just wanted to mention those two points. So thank you very much.
I believe she mentions that customer in one of the therapy sessions, or at some other scene, she says, "This man never touched me."
Right.
You know, she's clearly really likes this man. They have a relationship, almost a social relationship. And I think they both benefit from it. You know, she calls him, says, "Can I come over?" She's feeling lonely and wants to be with this man who just likes to listen to her. It's a wonderful, wonderful characterization. Yeah.
I mean, she's sharing with him her nudity, but at the same time, there's no physical contact. So it's a fascinating exchange that's taking place. And I also can't think of another Hollywood film that until this point had tried to get into the mind of a prostitute. And the therapy sessions clearly do. We do get into Brie Daniels' mind as she discusses what it is like to do her job. And it's not like she's doing it for because she loves it. I think it's the second therapy session where she suggests she's very conflicted about the kind of work she does.
Yeah, well, I got the impression that she's actually addicted to this, that she needed to do it because that is where she exhibits full control. Yeah. She says to her therapist, "He's nervous, but I'm not. I know what I'm doing." And in one part of the movie where she auditions for a part, because she wants to be an actress, she doesn't get the part. So you see, here she's a star in her role as a call girl, but not such much as an actress. So she's in full control and she's great. And she's so addicted to that part.
And it's fascinating to contrast that with the other acting she does with the first man we see her with, who, you know, this is where she's looking at her watch when she's faking excitement.
Yes, hysterical. My angel, and she's looking at her watch. It was hysterically.
Right.
There is a wonderful interview with Jane Fonda that's only about 2 years old on the recent Criterion edition of the film. The interview was conducted by Liana Douglas, a wonderful supporting actress. And Fonda cites the fact that she said one of the prostitutes she interviewed would be filing her nails behind the client's back while he was on top of her. So looking at the watch was maybe a little more restrained, but she got a lot of this in real life. And she got so much research done that a day or two before the shoot started, she went to Pakula and said, "I don't think I'm up to this. I can't do this. It's too much for me." And he refused to let her out of it. Thank heavens.
Thank heaven for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you so much.
Marjorie. Next, we have Jean Aaron.
The DP. When does he start doing his work? Does he take a look at the script and then does storyboards? I mean, you showed us examples of all these fantastic shots, and that's why I'd like to watch it again to take it all in. But how and when do they start creating those amazing compositions? Well, and it's a combination of the director and the DP.
Yes, the DP in this case is probably one of the early people to read the script as soon as it's gotten financing and studio approval, perhaps even before then. And clearly, when Willis and Pakula decided to shoot in this widescreen, call it anamorphic, call it CinemaScope format, they knew what they were doing. They knew the kind of environment they wanted to display. And so when they next turned to scouting locations and thinking about designing the sets where things were built, including Bree's apartment, that was all a studio set, not surprisingly. Willis, you'll see photos of him with a viewfinder, which is set to the widescreen format. And he's sizing up where things should be in the frame. And Pakula is probably standing right next to him, taking a look himself. And they're agreeing in advance on this. And then, of course, always ready to make adjustments when they get there with the cast and the lights, and it doesn't look quite like they had imagined it, and they have to tweak things. But I would say Willis in particular was involved from the get-go.
Yeah, I think it ranges. There are some DPs like Willis that definitely influence in the composing of a shot. And there are other cases where the director insists, no, I'm directing. This is where the camera's gonna go over here. But clearly this was not that kind of a collaboration. This was collaborative.
Just so everyone knows, calling a cinematographer a DP is taken exception with by the DGA, the Directors Guild. They don't believe that anyone on a film credit should have the title of director other than the director. Just a little film trivia there. But that's,
you know, my definition. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble for this. I often call the DGA the Dictators Guild of America.
I thought you were going to shorten the word dictators for a second.
Oh, well, that, you know.
But, ooh, I got spicy.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of tension. But one final thing I will say is it's very rare for a director of photography to transition to directing on their own. And Gordon Willis did it just once in a film called Windows that was not well received. But
he denounced the film, said he should not have made it. So
yeah, but what an eye the man had. But anyway, thank you so much, Gene.
A lot of times a film will have a color palette. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Piano, but it's very blue. And if you watch a movie like The Last Emperor, you know, a lot of the stories told and in light and through color, and, you know, the different color temperatures of the light set a when you have that blue cast, it's a totally different feeling than if it was exposed properly for sunlight. So
all of which is decided in advance.
Oh, yes. I would see Gordon Willis actually doing like lighting plots, I'm sure. And it was believed that if you didn't land on your mark, you weren't lit. You know, that was it. I'm sorry I stepped on you, Daniel.
No. I'm smiling, Laurie, because you reminded me of a story that was told to me firsthand where Rob Reiner was in Washington, D.C., shooting portions of A Few Good Men there, I believe. And he got into an argument with his cinematographer, Robert Richardson. And he said, I want this film to have a gold look, and it has a blue look. Why doesn't it have a gold look? Because they've just gotten the film back from the laboratory. And Robert Richardson is a brilliant, brilliant cameraman, and he's very intimidated by Rob Reiner. And this wonderful technician I knew who told me the story witnessed them. And he took a look at the report from the laboratory that said, print the dailies blue. Because Reiner's previous film, Misery, I think, had a blue look to it. And it was the laboratory that had printed the film with more of a bluer look. And Richardson offered my friend at the time a job because he saved him in front of the director. But that's just an example.
Well, we have another question.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Gene.
Thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
Susan Friedberg?
Since I lived through it, I mean, this is very much a woman's lib movie. Her need to take control and her not being that interested in, you know, going off to Pennsylvania and raising a family and having kids. I mean, it was very much, and I love when she says to the therapist, well, maybe I'll see you next week, because she knew herself, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it was that time. And it was a very heady time. I was wondering if there are any other movies you can pinpoint that had that type of a theme in it.
That's a great point you mentioned, Susan, because Hollywood is always very late to catch up to things. And you'd think at the height of Women's Lib, there would be a bunch of films addressing those issues. There were very few. 2 years before, Francis Coppola did make The Rain People with Shirley Knight. She leaves her husband and children because she's trying to find herself, and she goes on this road trip. That was very, very unusual. And that was made for Warner Brothers. And then Barbara Lawden, the same year, I know, made a film called Wanda, which is kind of a neo-noir independent movie about a woman on the road as well. But it was a strange transitional time where they weren't catching up to women's lib issues as rapidly as perhaps they were in Europe among European filmmakers.
I think Clute, if anything, was kind of at the starting point of the studios catching on to this idea that women would want to see themselves portrayed as seeking independence and strength. So I can't think of too many movies that preceded Clute with that sort of theme.
The only one that comes to mind is Butterfield 8, but it's much subtler, much, you know.
That's 9 years earlier or 11 years earlier, whatever it is. And of course, the production code is still very much in place. So there's a limit to what they can talk about and show.
Tim Burrows?
Hello, a very quick question here. My point, which was Gene almost stole my thunder earlier on, was, where does Willis stop and Pakula start? And did the balance of that relationship change as they worked together some more? So into President's Men and Parallax View.
Very good question. Tim is a friend of mine, by the way. Thanks for tuning in, Tim.
I'm in Edinburgh, so an international.
Yes.
Welcome. Yes.
My answer will probably not satisfy you because I think it varies from scene to scene that they're working on. Some scenes require last-minute collaboration. Others may have been pre-visualized very strictly, and they adhere to it. And flexibility is extremely important when you are directing and photographing a film. You have to be prepared to roll with the unexpected, whether the talent deciding, I can't read these lines, they're terrible. All sorts of things happen. But I can't think of a fixed answer to your question. Maybe you can help, Max.
Well, there's a style that emerges in Pakula's work after Clute, where you can see this suspense style emerging in how he stages his scenes. And I have to believe that they were joined at the hip during a lot of at least the visual planning, at least for a lot of them.
If you look at Woody Allen, who collaborated with Gordon Willis quite a bit, you can see the great influence of Willis, because pre-Annie Hall, Woody's films were exposed for exposure. There was no creative or cinematic lighting. And when you see Annie Hall and then you look at Woody Allen's movies after that, you'll see a huge change in style. Some of that is Gordon. I think they did, I don't want to say, like five films together, maybe?
Eight.
You know, and then of course, one of his more recent films, he worked with Vittorio Storaro, who I think they gave too much free rein to on that, but personally. But yeah, everything in film is collaborative, and it's very hard. You know, I think if you're smart, you hire the DP that you know can give you what you want, and you work collaboratively on a visual color palette. Again, I have to bring up The Last Emperor. When you see him in his jail cell, it's very green and bland. And then when you see, you know, when he's a little emperor, it's just breathtaking. So I really think it's kind of, you know, simpatico.
Well stated. I'm surrounded by two film teachers here, by the way. So
I'm
very intimidated right now.
I promised I wouldn't step on him, but I can't help myself.
It's okay.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making this podcast possible. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for tuning in, everyone, and take care.